Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. According to the Salt Lake Tribune, a Utah State University employee was paid for 2 years while he didn't work. The employee at the school's Price campus was supposed to oversee programs for local businesses. Instead, he failed to show up and was paid more than $157,000 in salary and benefits. More broadly, a dense 24-page internal audit details favoritism and inappropriate working and hiring practices at USU Eastern, small satellite campus 200 miles from the university's primary location in Logan. It also documents shoddy accounting policies that hadn't been updated since 1999. We'll talk with Tribune reporter Courtney Tanner about this and the closure of inclusion centers at various Utah college campuses. Help join us following the news. Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. According to the Salt Lake Tribune, a Utah State University employee was paid for 2 years while he didn't work. The employee at the school's Price campus was supposed to oversee programs for local businesses. Instead, he failed to show up and was paid more than $157,000 in salary and benefits. And more broadly, a dense 24-page internal audit details favoritism and inappropriate working and hiring practices at USU Eastern, which is a satellite campus 200 miles from the university's primary location in Logan. It documents shoddy accounting and policies that hadn't been updated since 1999. We're going to talk about this with Salt Lake Tribune reporter Courtney Tanner. Also, we'll talk a little later in the program about closure of inclusion centers at various Utah colleges and campuses. Salt Lake Tribune reporter Courtney Tanner joins us. Courtney, thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Tom. Happy to be here.
Good morning. Appreciate you you being with us. So tell us a few more of the details. When was this? Well, who is this and when was he hired?
Yeah, it's a lot to digest, but Morin Tyler Agner was hired at Utah State University to oversee some of the local business programs that are run through the university, but that support local businesses in the region. And he was hired in July 2021 for that position. He'd worked at USU and other positions before that, but was supposed to help these businesses and did not show up to work.
And this was important work, potentially, because, Price area, mining area, but it's kind of been declining economically. Businesses really needed this.
Exactly. This is a region of the state that, I'd say is often forgotten. It's for so long it depended on mining as its economy, and it's moving away from that, and a lot of the mines have shut down, and the local businesses coming in to kind of revive the area really could have used this support. And they actually had called into the school several times to say, look, this specialist that's supposed to help us is not responding, and we need this support.
So what exactly was Mr. Agner hired to do? What were the, I guess, scope of his duties?
Yeah, there's two different programs that are run out of USU Eastern for this. One is called the Custom Fit Program, which helps new businesses by reimbursing some of their training costs for employees. And the other is the Small Business Development Center, which helps businesses with all sorts of things, consulting, advertising, marketing. And he was supposed to oversee both of those programs to bolster these businesses in the area.
Now, I guess it doesn't matter that much, but there are gradations here, I guess. Did he do any work at all or no work or what happened?
It's a good question. The auditors, it was an internal audit done by the school. They found that he had done minimal work, I think is how they put it. And it was really hard to trace really what he'd done at all. They had asked Agner for evidence that he had done work, and he never provided that to the auditors. So they looked through his emails and, different databases that these business programs run on. The Small Business Development Center database had absolutely nothing ever entered by Agner into it. And there were some contracts within the Custom Fit program that he had signed off on, but essentially, yes, very minimal work done in the very first couple months that he was hired. And then for 2 years after that, nothing.
So the work not done, business has not helped, plus salary benefits paid out. How much?
$157,470.
Yeah. And that money, I think, has not been recovered. It's hard to recover that, I guess.
That's right. The spokesperson for USU said that at this point, the school doesn't think that they have a way to reclaim that money. It is state taxpayer money that went to his salary and grant funding that went to his salary. So it's essentially taxpayers will eat the cost of it, right? If USU can't recover it, it means they have to move money in a different budget to repay these business programs. And then, yeah, there's a whole in different index that could have gone to something else.
So I guess fairly early on, people did notice, I guess, including these businesses. Tell me a bit about that. Were there reports that came in?
A lot of reports that came in actually. There were other staff that were reporting him to administrators because they were frustrated, by this absence. The school's HR office got several complaints. The Utah System of Higher Education, which oversees USU, got complaints. And I talked to a couple folks who said that they reported this to federal investigators. So, the flags were raised in the situation.
So when did things start happening in terms
In,
of investigation?
yeah. So about a year ago, actually, in July 2023, a complaint was sent to the Utah Attorney General's office, and that's what kind of got the ball rolling.
And then I guess the Tribune got a hold of a what an audit and then an HR report, I think.
Exactly. Yeah, there were two separate processes to investigate what had happened here, both of them internal, but yeah, one was an internal audit of the situation, money exchanging hands, the programs, and then the other was, yeah, HR focused and, had recommendations as far as how do you deal with these employees.
So this audit uncovered not only just the one, you could call it, bad apple, Mr. Agner, uncovered some policies, which I guess the most charitable way to put this is need updating. Tell me about what the audit found in terms of procedures and policies.
Yeah, it actually had a pretty interesting wide scope. You're right. I mean, it does kind of say this one employee situation was bad, but it actually is kind of an example of other problems that are going on at the university that kind of let this happen, essentially. The biggest one is that USU hadn't updated its policy on nepotism and cronyism since 1999. So it's a 25-year-old policy.
Tell me about the chain of command here. This is important. And Mr. Agner lived with one of his bosses, I think.
Yeah, so I'll start at the top. So the department head was Brian Warnick, and he oversaw technical education, that department. And then the associate department head was Jamie Kano. And then underneath Jamie Kano was Ethan Migliori, who is the director of non-credit training. And then Tyler Agner reported to Ethan Migliori, as the specialist in the business programs. What's interesting is that Kano and Agner lived together. So there was only one person in that command chain separating, these two people that, had some kind of a relationship, a friendship. But all three of the administrators, too, that were over Agner had reported to auditors that they were actually friends with him, too. So really a messy situation, no matter how you look at it.
It seems like some of these folks were covering up for Mr. Agner.
Yeah, that's what the audit ultimately points to is that, these administrators that had friendships with Agner, ultimately did cover up for him. Some of them admitted that they did some of the work that Agner was supposed to do. There's these email conversations where they say, like, let's just move him to a different payroll so he can keep getting paid. Like, I just care that he keeps getting paid. So yeah, definitely was influenced by friendships in the administration, according to this audit.
So what has happened, Mr. Agner and the others? Any, punishments here?
Yes, Agner was let go. He had been put on leave in October and then was let go in January while this audit was, this investigation was taking place. The HR report had recommended that Kano be fired, as well as losing his administrative duties. So, like, that was the first step, and then also to consider firing him. The university did remove those administrative duties, but then Kano resigned before anything else could happen. So those are kind of the HR actions, and then Ethan Migliori has actually remained in his position, kind of overseeing the same programs. It didn't have recommendations as far as, his employment, but the audit said, he needs to be more accountable when employees are not showing up for work and not reporting like sick time while they're not showing up for work. So lots of recommendations.
Yeah, we'll get to some specifics here, but an interesting kind of a subplot here. There was a gentleman who was hired, I guess, to do the work that Agner wasn't doing. Tell me a bit about that.
Yeah, this is an interesting part of it. A man named Roger Coyle was hired for the same position that Agner was in. Essentially, Agner wasn't doing the work, and so they decided to hire this guy, Roger Coyle, to come in and do the work. And Roger Coyle notices, that this guy's on his budget, and he's like, "Why? Like, I don't even know who this is. Why is this guy on my budget?" And Ethan Migliori actually removes Roger Coyle's custom fit responsibilities over this. There's emails that show, Ethan Migliori getting upset about this and essentially, retaliating, if we can use that word, against Roger for bringing up concerns about the program and Agner and the pay situation that they were kind of covering up.
Migliori is still in his job, I guess.
Migliori is still in his job. Roger Coyle is also in his job, but again, it has not had the custom fit responsibilities anymore. He's just over the Small Business and Development Center, which is really it's an interesting situation. Neither, I should point out, neither Ethan nor Roger would comment to me. Actually, really, no one would comment to me. I called Jamie Kano, I called Tyler Agner. Just nobody wanted to chat.
Another interesting part of the story, I guess you nailed down, or this audit nailed down, I guess to further prove Mr. Agner was not doing his work, you looked at the Blanding campus and that person who was overseeing these programs. There's a pretty stark difference.
Yeah, that's right. It's interesting. So there are these small business development centers at different universities and different campuses across the state. And so there is one at USU's Blanding campus, which is fairly close by, kind of serves that southeast corner of Utah. And that person had logged 575 hours counseling businesses in a year, 1 year from August 2021 to August 2022, while Agner had reported 0 hours.
Yeah, a pretty big difference, obviously. So you have another story out just this morning, Courtney. The headline here, Five Fixes Utah State University Will Make After This Audit Showed the Employee Who Paid for 2 Years Didn't Work. Take me through these. What does USU say they're going to do?
Yeah, there's quite a number of steps that USU, was advised to do after this audit and this, situation, like I said, that kind of exposed bigger issues with like accounting and relationship policies at the school. So the first one is updating that 1999 cronyism and nepotism policy to include different types of relationships. So initially, the policy basically said like you can't have family. You can't like have direct reporting lines between family, but that's pretty outdated. Even Utah State Code, is more expansive than that. It says, any relationships, friendships, household members, and not just direct reporting lines. It could be any kind of reporting line. And so they recommend that Utah State update its policy in a similar way as Utah Code to, be more expansive and more aware of the different type of relationships and conflicts that exist.
The number two, I guess, they're going to pay back certain expenses. I guess they can maybe recoup some.
So yeah, no recouping, unfortunately, but the university is essentially going to move what it paid out to Agner in salary and benefits. It's going to move money back into those accounts. So those accounts run off of funds and state legislative money, essentially taxpayer money. And so they'll just move funds back into those to support these local businesses, but it means there will be essentially a gap somewhere else in USU's budget.
Third fix, accurately report employee absences. I guess Mr. Migliori was not reporting that Mr. Agner was gone, I guess.
Exactly. Yeah. When Agner was absent, he didn't ever submit any requests for sick or vacation time. And he had a lot of hours in that, which is interesting part of this too. But yeah, his manager, Ethan Migliori, never reported that he was absent. And so yeah, the recommendation is that both Migliori and other managers throughout USU Eastern, account better for if their team is absent and follow up with HR and just essentially be more accountable to that process.
Apparently, the audit, according to your story, says that Mr. Agner, had some health issues, but I guess he never filed for sick leave.
So there was a note in the audit that seemed like he maybe had tried to apply for disability. It's really not clear, and I tried to ask the school for some clarification on it. They denied to talk about it. So it's not clear if he, didn't finish the application process or if the school's HR office delayed it. There's something that was off there, but it doesn't really state what it is.
Okay. The fourth fix is to better advertise the business programs because there is money yearly. I guess at least one or two of these years there's money left on the table that shouldn't be.
Exactly. Yeah, the Utah System of Higher Education administers this program, and their recommendation is essentially, you're allocated this money from the state to help these businesses use it all, like really allocate it to these businesses. That's what it's for. And because Agner wasn't doing his job, businesses weren't getting the money, and there was like pretty large reserves every year. So yeah, the recommendation is, advertise this program better, do the work and get these businesses the support that these programs are meant for.
The fifth and final fix budgeting practices. What are they going to do?
Yes, there were a lot of notes in the audits about just, problems with, shoddy budgeting practices, essentially. There weren't policies for how to use these custom fit funds. Some businesses were getting like a larger share of money than others. So basically, they said, you need to have policies, you need to cap, which Roger Coyle actually did come in and do when he was hired, put a cap on how much the companies can get in reimbursement. So it's not all going to one company. There was also part of the original tip that came into the Attorney General's office, which I think is worth noting, is that this person that put in the tip was worried that, money was being kind of siphoned out of the university illegally. But there was no evidence found of that by the audit, which is good. But still, it raised concerns and points to accounting issues.
Courtney, anything else you'd like to say about this story?
I think what's interesting is the auditors say, because you have these unsubstantiated expenses, it could jeopardize future appropriations. So, like a big warning to Utah State to handle money correctly.
Yeah, extraordinary thing. Well, we hope it's extraordinary, right? Hopefully this gets fixed. Thanks for telling us about this.
Yeah.
Courtney Tanner, Salt Lake Tribune reporter. After break, Courtney, I'd love to talk about your stories, recent stories on the closure of various cultural and inclusion centers at various Utah college campuses. We'll have more with Courtney Tanner following this break. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We have with us Salt Lake Tribune reporter Courtney Tanner. We talked earlier in this hour about a USU Eastern employee who's paid for 2 years while he didn't work and all the ins and outs of that, the fixes, hopefully. I want to turn next to a series of stories, Courtney, about the closure of cultural centers, inclusion centers at various Utah college campuses. So Courtney, first of all, tell us about what the legislature did. HB, I think it's 261, is it? Tell me what this law said.
Yeah, so this is essentially Utah's version of the anti-DEI measures that have been kind of going around in conservative areas of the country. Essentially, it's nuanced, but it's aimed at these diversity, equity, and inclusion offices, programs, titles, supports in higher education. There are provisions that apply to K through 12 and government offices, but the bulk of the bill is higher education. Essentially, it says that a college or university cannot have a program that only caters to like a specific racial or gender identity, that every program that schools have should be open to all students, and that schools should also establish, you know, these student success centers in addition to that, that they cater to all students.
No, I think most Utah college campuses, well, you know, across the country, most campuses have these centers. What are people saying about, I know you've talked to folks who are saddened, outraged by the closure of these centers. What were they getting from these centers? Why were these centers important?
Yeah, these centers, you know, I went to the University of Utah Center for Equity and Student Belonging to talk to some students, and they talked about how, you know, as students of color, they face different challenges and different barriers on campus. A lot of them are first generation students, which, you know, does correlate with students of color. More students of color are likely to be the first in their family to go to college. And so they were relying on these centers to help them, you know, get tutoring, navigate the university, sign up for classes, print off papers, you know, kind of the meat of the university. But then there was this other part of it that was just, you know, finding people that looked like them, finding a place where they could decompress if they experienced something racist on campus, you know, finding a place that celebrated their culture, you know, just a home, essentially, a place where they weren't the minority, where every single campus in this state, every public college campus is, you know, predominantly white. So these were spaces for them to feel comfortable.
So, Courtney, play devil's advocate for us here. I guess from the legislature's perspective, okay to have these centers as long as you open it up for everybody. But you know, what's wrong with that?
The legislature feels like certain funds are going to specific populations when, you know, all students need help, right? So there might be a white student who's low income who could use the same supports, essentially. That's the legislature's argument. And so they would like, you know, this, I guess, even distribution of resources so that all students can succeed. That's the legislature's argument with their bill.
Now, the Utah Commissioner of Higher Education, kind of interesting. He says he did not tell public colleges that they had to shutter their culture centers, quoting from your story. He did predict to you that that's probably going to be the outcome. And indeed, I think at least three colleges have closed down these centers. Is the legislature continuing to keep an eye on this? Is that why these are closing?
Yeah, it's an interesting situation. So yesterday was the deadline to, you know, start complying with this bill. And, you know, in the couple of days before that, we'd seen a lot of public colleges, particularly the University of Utah and Weber State University, announce that they were closing their cultural centers. And it came as kind of a shock because the bill specifically says, like, look, you don't have to close these cultural centers. Like, if you have a Black cultural center, you don't have to close it. I mean, you do have to offer resources there to everyone. So if a white student comes in, you have to offer them the same resources, but you don't have to close it. And that was a really big selling point in the bill, actually. You know, nationwide, people were pointing to Utah as this, you know, trying to find this compromise and this balance. And then all of these schools are announcing, well, we're going to close these centers anyway. And so it's kind of a surprising move. You know, students were surprised and shocked. And so I talked to the commissioner of higher education, who said, you're right. You know, they don't have to close these centers. Our guidance doesn't say they have to close these centers. But the commissioner said it felt like an inevitability to him, that he felt that that's what the bill was pointing to, that if schools didn't close them, they were going to have to eventually anyway, that the legislature is still keeping an eye on higher education in Utah and really wants to rein in DEI programs, period.
I guess this is, I don't know if you know, this is happening mostly in Republican states, is DEI laws.
Right. Yeah, it's definitely a conservative driven movement. Utah, you know, as everyone knows, is a red state. And so it's, you know, it's happening here, but it's happening, you know, across the country, too, in places that are Republican majority.
So I wonder, this is pure speculation. You can join in or not, Courtney, but I could imagine, you know, some of these students making different choices about where they go to school.
You know, the students I talked to and the faculty that I've talked to have said they wouldn't be surprised, right? They wouldn't be surprised if your staff come to the University of Utah, for instance, to work there, because now there's not these support centers for students and faculty that use them. And yeah, some of the students I talked to too said, you know, why would students come here when they're not going to feel accepted, that there's not going to be a place for them to belong?
Now, current students, I guess, you know, tell me a little bit more about some of the specific people you talk to. They're, yeah, I guess you can characterize the range of emotions. Sadness, I could be one of those.
Yeah, I think it was truly a range. I mean, there was, you know, anger and sadness and these events. They had these farewell events for the centers at the U that were closing, and I described them as like a funeral. I mean, truly, it was very somber. You know, people were signing memorial books. They were saying goodbye to these centers. I mean, the Center for Equity had been around for 52 years. The Women's Resource Center at the U had been around for 53 years. I mean, these are longstanding centers, and, you know, students saying goodbye to them, that they'd relied on these resources. Alumni came back. I mean, it was really a huge kind of showing of support, but also, you know, regret that they were going away. Some of the students that I talked to at the youth center, you know, said, I don't know where we're going to find space on campus anymore. And they were worried. They were scared.
Have we heard from any legislators to say, yeah, we're satisfied with what's happening, or we didn't intend this?
You know, I've seen Representative Katie Hall, who sponsored HB 261, talking in other news outlets saying, like, this is kind of the intention, and she's glad to see that schools are doing what they're doing. So I definitely think that it is, you know, like the commissioner said, what lawmakers wanted.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Courtney, anything else you'd like to say about this one?
I guess I would just say, you know, keep following the Tribune, read some of the pieces we put up. We'll keep following this issue. There's a lot there to keep kind of digging into. Yeah, I guess we'll see what's to come too.
Courtney, I'd like to have you talk about one more story here following a break. Utah officials were not racist when they stopped the Ute tribe from buying Tabby Mountain. It's according to a judge's ruling. Are you able to stay with us, talk about that one?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, great. Let's take a brief break. We're talking with Salt Lake Tribune reporter Courtney Tanner. More following this break. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We have with Sport of the Hour Salt Lake Tribune reporter Courtney Tanner. One more story here from Courtney. The headline, Utah officials were not racist when they stopped Ute tribe from buying Tabby Mountain, according to a judge's ruling. What was at issue here in this this lawsuit, Courtney?
Yeah, it's a really interesting kind of complicated case, but I'll give it kind of the Reader's Digest version. Essentially, there was this property in eastern Utah around Tabby Mountain that the state DNR had wanted. Essentially, the Department of Natural Resources wanted this area. They wanted to turn it into kind of a wildlife preserve and open up to the public. But the Ute Indian tribe of Utah also wanted this area. You know, it's ancestral homelands. It is really significant to it. Tabby Mountain, the name Tabby is actually for a chief of the Ute tribe. So you have these two entities that want this property. The Utah Trust Lands Administration, which oversees this area and has, you know, land that it essentially maximizes profits off of to benefit Utah school children, put this land up for sale. And the Ute tribe put in a bid, and the Department of Natural Resources put in a bid. The Ute tribes was higher. The Trust Lands Administration went to the Department of Natural Resources and said, hey, do you want to up your bid? They did, but they didn't have the money to back it. So essentially, the sale gets pulled. They suspend the sale. And the Ute tribe has said in a lawsuit that that was a racist move, that essentially, you know, the tribe had put in more money and it deserved to get the property. And they were prevented from buying the property when the sale was suspended.
So the Trust Lands Administration predictably happy with this, I guess.
That's right. So this ruling is pretty significant.
a U.S. district judge threw out the tribe's claims of discrimination, right? Discrimination under the law. So the tribe can no longer argue in its lawsuit that's still ongoing, I'd like to point out, but it can no longer argue that discrimination was at play in this situation.
What is the Ute tribe saying?
The Ute tribe hasn't responded. We requested comment. The business committee that oversees the Ute tribe didn't want to comment on the situation. In the past, you know, they've said that this lawsuit's really important, and they've said that it feels like retaliation, essentially, that the state was trying to retaliate against the tribe for not selling this property.
In your story, this is interesting, a whistleblower apparently 2022 said that behind the scenes, the Trust Lands Administration had been pressured by state lawmakers to keep that sale of Tabby Mountain off the radar of other buyers. Anything yeah. come of that?
Tim Donaldson, a really interesting case there. Brian Mathley, my former colleague, covered this when it happened. But yeah, Tim Donaldson is this whistleblower who was, you know, in charge of this Tabby Mountain sale when it was happening, and said, yeah, there was some backhand dealings, you know, where state lawmakers said, hey, Trust Lands Administration, pull this property because we want the State Department of Natural Resources to have it. Because if the Department of Natural Resources has it, they can charge users, you know, it's public land, they can benefit off of it financially for years to come. But if the Ute tribe gets it, it's private land.
So there was a ruling in favor of the tribe, apparently. So the law says that this only applies to persons and citizens. Ute tribe is a sovereign nation, but I guess the judge ruled that the tribe can be, I guess, considered a person or a citizen.
Yeah, this is actually a really huge win, just for tribal sovereignty and for these issues moving forward. I'm curious how it applies if other tribes in Utah or the Ute tribe files, you know, future lawsuits, because this is a huge win. Essentially, under federal law, if you're suing for equal treatment, you know, under the Constitution, that's supposed to apply to persons or citizens. The state had argued that the Ute tribe can't sue under that because it's a sovereign nation, that it's not a person that's being affected by equal treatment. But the judge in this case said, no, actually, you know, the tribe and its members can be considered individuals that are harmed in this case. And so collectively, the tribe can sue for civil rights for its members.
Anything else you'd like to say about this one, Courtney?
Yeah, the case still moves on. So there's... you know, a lot of things were kind of thrown out when you file a lawsuit. You know, you put in a lot and, you know, kind of see what sticks, essentially. Governor Spencer Cox was actually removed from the lawsuit. So he's no longer being sued. The Trust Lands Administration is the same thing. However, there are individuals within it that remain. There's a conspiracy charge against the former Trust Lands Administration director at the time of this suspended sale, and he can still be tried for conspiracy in this case, conspiracy, you know, to commit fraud against the tribe. So while a lot was thrown out, the case still moves forward, and there's a lot of still important and significant arguments that can be made in it.
All right. Well, thanks for telling us about all these stories, Courtney Tanner. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Courtney Tanner, Salt Lake Tribune reporter. Appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Okay. And bye now. We are going to continue the program here. We have a few minutes left in the program. We're going to reach back into the archives here. Very interesting conversation I was able to have with legendary lyricist Sheldon Harnick from several years back. 2013 was when he came to Logan for events with the Utah Festival Opera and Musical Theater. They were presenting one of his operas. Of course, he is lyricist for Fiddler on the Roof. And that's what we get talking about in this excerpt from this conversation. Let's hear just about 12 or 13 minutes of my conversation from 2013 with lyricist Sheldon Harnick. Speaking of ideas that... when you're presented with them, it might seem problematic. Fiddler on the Roof. This is, of course, post-Holocaust. This is the 1960s and a musical about European Jews, pogroms, exile, might have seemed a bit problematic.
Well, Jerry Bach and I did a lot of reading, looking for subjects for musicals. And somebody I can't remember who. Somebody sent me a big, thick book by Sholem Aleichem called Wandering Star, which was about a Yiddish theatrical troupe wandering around Eastern Europe. And I loved it, and I gave it to Jerry Buck, and he loved it. And we thought, this should be a musical. Who would do it? And we thought of Joe Stein. So we sent it to him. Joe read it. And he said, it is wonderful, but it's too big. There are too many characters. It covers too many years. It's too big a canvas to put on stage. But since we love this, the writing of this man, Sholem Aleichem, let's see what else he wrote that might make a musical. We read more stories by him, and we stumbled on Tevye's Daughters. And when we read that, it was just so human. It was funny. It was human. It was warm. It was interesting. And we thought, this could make a musical. When we started work on it, we thought, if we do our job right and we capture the beauty of the stories, maybe it'll run a year or two and it will have been worth it. We had no idea that it was going to turn into what it turned into.
Hmm. And you had a little bit of trouble finding financial backers, right?
Hal Prince, we did a lot of backers auditions, and a lot of the women who headed the groups that bought theater parties, a lot of them were Jewish. And they were quite worried by the fact that there was darkness in the musical. At the end of the first act, there's a pogrom. At the end of the second act, there's an exile. And they were worried. They thought it might be difficult to sell tickets. And at the end of each audition, Hal Prince would get up and say, ladies, there's going to be a lot of humor in this. There's a lot of laughter. Joe Stein is noted for his comic scripts. And in the lead, we have a very funny man. We have Zero Mostel. Eventually, he did raise the money. But we went to Detroit for the beginning of our pre-Broadway tour and discovered that there was a newspaper strike. So there were difficulties.
Hmm. I was listening to another interview that you gave. You tell an interesting story about Harold Clurman, a critic, and the meaning of Fiddler.
Well, Harold Clurman was my favorite critic because not only did he do interesting reviews, but he gave you a lot of history connected with the authors and the plays that he wrote about. When he did his review of Fiddler in The Nation magazine, he said, all my friends told me, they said, Harold, you should go see this. It's like a religious experience. He said, I went to see it, and I was disappointed. And then he said, but the more I thought about it, the more I realized that it wasn't a matter of being accurate about the lives of the Jewish communities that these fellows were writing about. But people, the immigrants, the people who came to America, their memories were different. They were not accurate either. What they remembered was the sense of community, which was so important. And that's what this show captures. He said, so my initial impression was wrong. Mm. It's a wonderful musical. Mm. And I've never seen a critic do that, start out by saying it's not so good and end up by raving about it.
Mm. And in a sense, the stories of Sholem Aleichem and Fiddler, you're preserving the memory of some of these, a lot of these communities which are gone.
Well, our director, Jerome Robbins, told us that when he was 6 years old, his parents had taken him to Poland, to the area where they came from. And Jerry remembered, even at the age of six, he remembered the experience as being very emotional. During World War II, when he read about these little villages, such as the one he visited, being exterminated, he was horrified. And when we asked him to direct what became Fiddler on the Roof, he said, for me, it's an opportunity to put that culture back on stage, give it another 25 years of life. Mm-hmm. And it's been much more than 25 years. But Robbins was like a man obsessed. Mm-hmm. He did endless research and did an extraordinary job.
Including, was it his suggestion to go to a Hasidic wedding?
Yes, he took us to Hasidic weddings. He took us to holiday celebrations at various places. And things that he saw wound up in the show. For instance, I had never been to ceremonies that were that orthodox. And I saw the velvet cord that separated the men from the women. I saw at a wedding, I saw the men picking up the groom, lifting him in a chair, and the women lifting up the bride sitting in a chair. There was a man who came to all of these weddings, and he wandered around with a bottle on his head. And ultimately, that became the bottle dance. You know, so everything that Robin saw was grist for his mill.
If you just joined us, we're talking with Sheldon Harnick. We're very pleased to have him for the hour on Access Utah today. And, of course, we're talking about Fiddler on the Roof. Sheldon Harnick, a lyricist for She Loves Me and Fiorello and many others. Coyote Tales, maybe talk a little bit about that with the set music of Henry Mollicone. And also, Sheldon Harnick has provided English translations of opera libretti.
Some, yes.
So that's an interesting experience we want to talk about as well. So we're talking with Sheldon Harnick today. So you start out with Fiddler in Detroit. You go to Washington, I believe, end up in New York. Of course, going into it, you don't know. None of you know, right, that it's going to be the hit that it became?
Well, when we left Detroit, we didn't know. But when we got to Washington, we saw a sight that was it warmed my heart, but we couldn't understand it. We got to the theater to rehearse, and there was a long line of people waiting to buy tickets for Fiddler. And we thought, how can that be? There were no reviews in Detroit. It must be that everybody's called their friends and said, go see this show. That was very encouraging. And then when we got to New York, we saw the same phenomenon. There was this long line of people waiting to buy tickets.
So ticket sales increase, and then by the end of your scheduled run, you're selling out.
Yeah. In Detroit, that was another thing that chilled us. Hal told us that we had to stay in New York for 5 weeks. This was part of the deal he made with the theater owner. We had to be there for 5 weeks, but we only had a subscription for 3.5 weeks. So the last week and a half we were there, there was not one ticket sold. But by the end of that run, we were selling out.
Why do you think Fiddler hit? So it's part of our consciousness. You can't escape it.
Well, my own feeling is that it's because about something that is so universal in the relationship between parents and children. Parents grow up with a certain set of traditions, if you will, experiences. And as often as not, children tend to drift away from that. And it can be very difficult for parents to accept the fact that the children are not behaving in the way they expect them to or going in directions that they expect them to. This is universal. Fiddler has been done all over the world. And in every country, I think the relationships between parents and children are the same.
And even beyond stage versions, the movie, you've got Sunrise, Sunset at many weddings.
Well, that's the other aspect which I left out is that because of Jerry Robbins' insistence and making us rewrite, the show also has a wonderful book, a wonderful score, and those terrific dances of Jerry Robbins. So that also is important.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk a little bit about collaboration between you and Jerry Bock. I think some teams do it one way, some teams do it the other. Do you do lyrics first? He sets those. Does he do music first?
In our collaboration, it always started with music first. He would go into his studio. He would write musical numbers. And then at a certain point, he would send me a tape with anywhere from 8 to 12 numbers on it. And he would have a little preface, a spoken preface, saying, I think this is for The Butcher. I think this is for Tevye. I think this is whatever it is. And on every tape, I would find maybe 2 or 3 pieces of music that just affected me, so I couldn't wait to put lyrics to them. But somewhere along the line, I would have an idea for a song where I didn't want to be handcuffed by the music. I wanted the freedom to write it. And I remember the first time I gave Jerry a lyric, I wondered whether he could set a lyric as beautifully as he could write music first, and he could. Mm-hmm. And not only that, he was a wonderful editor. Jerry himself was a good lyricist, and when I gave him a lyric, quite often he would say, you know something, these 4 lines make the song. Let's scrap the rest of it, and let's just go with these 4 lines, and you'll rewrite the rest. So it was a very rich collaboration. Mm-hmm.
Did you and Fiddler, or apply more broadly in other musicals, for example, do you have anyone in mind? Did you have Zero Mostel in mind when you were writing some of these
things?
No,
we always,
that comes later.
Jerry and I always wrote for character and then invariably found the actor to fit that character.
Mm. And of course,
Jerry Robbins, because we actually, for Fiddler, we wanted an actor named Howard Da Silva, who had been in Fiorello and who was wonderful. But Robin said no. He said the character of Tevye is larger than life. He said Howard is wonderful, but he's just life size. I want somebody like Zero Mostel who's larger than life.
Mm-hmm. Which he certainly was.
Yes, he was.
Well, so when it came time to, I think it was still running on Broadway, wasn't it, when they made the film?
It was. Yeah, we ran on Broadway, I think, an additional year after the film came out.
Yeah. Did you have any involvement in the film?
The director, Norman Jewison, invited Jerry Bock and me to participate, but we had nothing to add to it, whereas the book writer, Joe Stein, did the film script and went to Yugoslavia where the film was filmed. He participated. Mm-hmm. We did not.
Did you have any trepidations about a film version?
No, I can't say that I did. Eventually, we were surprised that he cut one song. But he knew that it was that the film was very long, and also for the character of the young revolutionary, they had cast a man who did not sing all that well, and eventually they realized that the song he was singing was not effective, so they cut it.
Okay, what did you think of the film?
I loved it. Yeah. The first time I saw it, what disappointed me was that the man who played Tevye was not American; he's Israeli. And he English was his second or third language, so he was not as comfortable with the spoken humor as other people. And I was a little disappointed in that. But the second time I saw it, that didn't matter at all. I thought, oh, my goodness, he's wonderful. He's just wonderful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, of course, with film, then everybody gets to see the musical. Yeah.
And what Norman Jewison did was that he took a stage play and he made it into a genuine cinematic experience. Mm-hmm. The things the film... I'll use the word, there is no such word. The filmic things that he did were just beautiful.
That's a portion of my 2013 interview with legendary lyricist Sheldon Harnick. He was in town for work of his, I think, Coyote Tales, with the Utah Festival Opera and Musical Theater. We'll have a link to the entire interview with this episode of the program. Thanks for listening to Access Utah.